This is the scene from MIB's lead. Sometimes
this is where we take a left.
Seriously, as they arrive, people go on podcasts, YouTube videos, reporting that these men in blacks are really extraterrestrials. The MIBs often drive black vehicles with either no license plates or U.S. government. MIB comes to your house after an event, asking you for pictures or debris left that you might have collected. They can intimidate you. They can threaten you. If you don't cooperate with them, they might leave, but at 3 o'clock in the morning, something happens in your house, a break-in, and then you find that the items that you have regarding that UFO event, or the pictures you took,
said the two men asked for the piece of metal from the site, but when Richardson informed them that he had turned it over for testing, they threatened him. Quote, if you want your wife to stay as pretty as she is, then you'd better get the milk back. End quote. Richardson never heard from the men again and still has no idea how they knew about the metal.
Why didn't he go to the police? Why didn't he search on the internet? What do I do?
I think he may have gone to the police. There is no internet.
The men who did much to popularize the men in black in his own way. Author John Keel took the men in black to a whole nother level, as Keel discusses in the Mothman Prophecies. The men in black also frequented the small town of Point Pleasant, West Virginia, according to Keel. Usually dressed from head to toe in black suits, wearing white t-shirts, black ties, and black shoes, which all appeared to be perfect in appearance, but yet completely out of style for the time, even for 1966 standards. What may well have been the most notorious of all frightening events or a series of events involving the paranormal in the 1960s involved what many describe as a flying humanoid or flying reptilian, which became known as the Mothman. This purported Mothman.
At the time, it was believed that these individuals worked for a secret government organization tasked with suppressing any mention of UFOs or extraterrestrials within the public domain. But over the years, this assumption has evolved, and advocates of their existence now consider the possibility that these supposed government agents themselves might in fact be extraterrestrial in nature. The 1997 film of the same name made light of the MIB conspiracy and did so to disarming comic effect. Albert K. Bender set up an organization called the International Flying Saucers Bureau to investigate and report upon strange UFO activity being witnessed all over the world at that time. 1953, Bender suddenly and mysteriously shut down his operation and ceased all publication, leaving in the newsletter's final issue a rather ominous message.
We advise those engaged in saucer work to please be very cautious.
Colleagues reported his odd demeanor at the time, stating that he seemed agitated and nervous, as if someone or something had scared him out of his wits.
In 1964, Dr. Robert Jacobs was in charge of the optical instrumentation of ballistic missile testing. There he recorded footage of an ICBM and was surprised to find the extraordinary. Here he recalls the events in detail.
Your house? Flying down range, we've got all three stages of powered flight. And as the dummy warhead and the package flew on down range, we were all celebrating the fact that we had seen the thing and accomplished the mission.
So another interesting story concerned a man named Dr. Robert Jacobs, who was a highly qualified scientific professional, who in 1964, he was very much involved in film recording of missile launches out of White Sands Proving Ground in New Mexico, where ballistic missiles were being tested. And what they would do is they would launch these missiles and then record them.
Flying downrange, we got all three stages of powered flight, and as the dummy warhead and the package flew on down range, we were all celebrating the fact that we had seen the thing and accomplished the mission. When I got back to the base with the film the next day, I was called into the office of Major Florence J. Mansman, And there were three people in gray suits standing in there. There was a 16-millimeter camera and a screen set up. Major Mansman said, "Lieutenant, sit down and watch this." And suddenly he said, "Just watch this." And as I watched, the warhead, the dummy warhead, the chaff that was put out in front of it as a decoy to deflect the Washington missile, tracking radar.
And during one of these tests, the missile just went completely haywire and didn't perform as expected and crashed. And on review of the film the next day, when Jacobs and his supervisor, who was a major, noticed that there was an object, a UFO.
Everything was flying along, and suddenly, in the same direction, this stuff was flying at about 8,000 miles an hour.
You know, to keep it in frame, shot a beam of light at the warhead, flew over to the top, shot another beam of light at the warhead, flew around the direction it was flying, shot another beam of light at the warhead, flew down to another beam of light at the warhead, and flew out the same way it came in.
Well, I don't see it. Why didn't you see this when you were shooting it?
Well, it was 600 to 800 miles away from us.
Like a saucer type of an object that was clearly interacting with this missile beam. I think it was a very well-defined laser type of a beam that was directed at this missile.
In his daily life, people calling at all times of the day and night threatening his life, which has escalated into property damage. Intimidation is one of many techniques used to instill fear.
And he said, "Lieutenant, you are never to speak of this again. As far as you're concerned, this didn't happen."
Eventually, Major Mansman confirmed Dr. Jacobs' claims of a UFO interacting with the ICBM. The major also disclosed that two agents who were not the CIA took the footage and altered it. All film evidence of the UFO and its interactions with the missile were missing. The major reported that one agent said to him, "That leaves you off the hook, but not off disclosure. Understood?"
Somehow the major had said to Jacobs that these men told him they erased the flying saucer from this film. And they said, "You're off the
Bender
hook."
Bender did not eat or sleep properly for weeks after he closed the bureau and was said to have suffered with unbearable headaches during this time. When questioned about his sudden and inexplicable decision, he refused to elaborate and maintained this silence for many years afterwards. Almost a decade later, in 1962, Bender finally explained his actions, saying that he had been visited by three men dressed in black who had appeared out of thin air and warned him not to continue his work on UFOs. Some years later, in 1976, a well-known and highly respected family physician, Dr. Herbert Hopkins, was to report a very chilling encounter. Hopkins was home alone at his residence in Old Orchard Beach, Maine, on the night of the 11th of September. He was studying a UFO incident which had occurred some months prior, when the phone suddenly rang. Hopkins answered, and a man's voice was heard on the other end, identifying himself as a representative of the New Jersey UFO organization, something which later turned out to be bogus. The caller asked Hopkins if he was alone, and whether he could visit him to talk about the UFO case he was investigating. Hopkins agreed, and the man told him that he would be there shortly. The moment he hung up, Hopkins went to the front door to turn on his porch light and noticed that the man was already coming up the steps in front of his house. He recalled feeling a little unnerved by this, because even if the man had called from his neighbor's house, there was no way he could have reached the front door in the time it had taken Hopkins to walk from the phone over to the light switch. Bear in mind that this was before the advent of mobile phones. Nevertheless, he was still keen to hear what this man had to say, and upon inviting him in, Hopkins was struck by the stranger's appearance. He was a tall, skinny man who wore a dark, ill-fitting suit and had a black derby on his head. His skin was smooth and deathly pale, and when he sat down and removed his hat, Hopkins noticed that he was as bald as an egg. He had no hair whatsoever. He was devoid of eyebrows and eyelashes, His lips were a bright ruby red, and he spoke in an expressionless voice. There was no intonation or inflection in his tone, and all of his words were evenly spaced. Throughout their conversation, he sat motionless, his mouth being the only thing that moved. As if that wasn't disturbing enough, on one of the few occasions that the stranger did move another part of his body besides his lips, he happened to wipe his mouth with the back of his hand, which left a red smear across his cheeks. It was at this point that Hopkins realized the stranger was wearing lipstick, and then further noticed that his mouth was actually a perfectly straight slit. He didn't even have a pair of lips. Hopkins became very frightened at this point, and when the visitor asked him to remove the copper coin that was sat in his pocket, he complied immediately. How this strange man even knew that he had a copper coin in his pocket is a mystery, but throughout the conversation, the doctor had the distinct feeling that the visitor was somehow reading his mind. Hopkins held the coin in the palm of his hand as instructed, and the visitor simply told him to watch it. As he did, it changed color from copper to silver, then became blurry, almost as if it was going out of focus. It then disappeared right in front of his eyes. The visitor told an utterly bewildered doctor in no uncertain terms that if he did not destroy all of the information he had collected on the UFO case, he himself would suffer the same fate as the coin.
Off of disclosure. In other words, you're not in trouble now because we've cleaned the film up, but don't you talk about it. So that's 1964. And Jacobs, then you fast forward to the Disclosure Project with Dr. Stephen Greer. We're talking late 1990s now. And Jacobs did an interview with Greer and talked about this event. And that was published in Greer's book, I think, the following year, in 2000. And what Jacobs said in the aftermath of that was that he was subject to a range of harassment type of activities. Some of these things would include threatening phone calls at all times of the day. He even did vandalism against his property, property damage, and acts of intimidation of this sort, which, yeah, that's going to intimidate people. So the whole point of this type of activity, obviously, would be to frighten you, the witness, enough to realize you better not talk about this because you're dealing with people who will do damage to you. And if they can wiretap your phone, or if they can threaten you at any time of
turn
day.
Turn of sorts. The tale of Albert Bender may not have been the start of the MIB phenomenon. 28 years prior to Albert Bender's initial encounter on one afternoon in May of 1924, near the small town of Jem, West Virginia, a newsman named John Cole visited the site of a supposed airplane crash in Braxton County, where he was met by a man in a suit with high cheekbones, slanted eyes, and dark skin. He told him that no one was hurt and no crime had been committed. A farmer just outside Jem in Braxton County, now notorious for being known as a town plagued with tales of high strangeness, reported seeing an airplane crash into a nearby forest. Planes were not a commonality in that area at the time, and a plane crashing would have been big news around town. According to the farmer, the plane had an unusual appearance in that it lacked any noticeable wings, moved through the air in silence, and seemed unusually large in size. As big as a battleship is the way the farmer had described it. A group of men that included newsman John Cole and the local sheriff searched through the woods strategically for the downed aircraft. Within hours, they stumbled upon the crash site in a small clearing. According to Cole, "We weren't the first ones there, though. There were already five or six men in the clearing. Some of them were dressed in black business suits, neckties and all. And that seemed damned silly in that neck of the woods. Others were dressed in coveralls of a funny color, some kind of very shiny material. They were talking among themselves in a rapid-fire foreign language when they found them. They got real excited when they saw the search party. The men in coveralls ran into the wreck, like they were trying to hide. Some of the men in the search party were carrying guns, and one of them said to Cole, 'By God, they're spies,' and he raised his gun. The strangers were all small, just a little over 5 feet tall, and they were all Asian in appearance, with high cheekbones, slanted eyes, and dark skin. One of them spoke English. He told the men nobody was hurt and that everything was all right. He said he would call on the sheriff later and make out a complete report. There wasn't much they could do. No crime had been committed and nobody was hurt. According to Cole, while he was looking around, he spotted a little metal thingamajig on the ground. He picked it up and decided on keeping it. For whatever reason, he decided not to hand it over to one of the strange foreigners and put it in his pocket. After the odd event, he traveled back home to Weston and went to sleep with no hesitation. At around 3 a.m., John began to hear a pounding at the front door.
What they're capable of doing.
Happened to a Dr. Hopkins in Maine in 1976. He was met or contacted by a man in black who was bald, had dead white skin, and no lips. The lips were simulated with lipstick.
Now that...
of investigating famous mysterious UFO cases, reports, I have never found one that cannot be explained in prosaic earthly terms.
He once tried to bribe one of Travis Walton's co-workers. You know, Travis Walton had the very famous UFO encounter in 1975, where he was missing for 5 days. Class actually tried to bribe one of Walton's cohorts to deny the whole thing ever happened. He offered him $10,000. This is how Class worked constantly.
You know, just like Philip Class when he offered me the $10,000. That was a lot of money back in the 70s.
And there's always been very, very strong suspicion. No proof that I'm aware of, but very strong circumstantial evidence that Class was some kind of asset for the U.S. intelligence community doing work for them to discredit the subject. He definitely was promoted by Edward Condon of the famous Condon Committee from the late 1960s. That infamously tried to debunk UFOs scientifically.
Our latest book, Stanton Friedman and I have written Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. It's based upon years of archival research. He went to Harvard, read Donald Menzel's archival files. I went to the American Philosophical Society. I made several trips there. And what I found in the correspondence files was a plan to debunk those individuals who had very compelling cases, and also to attempt to reduce the credibility of scientists who had an interest in investigating UFOs and who were speaking publicly about that. I have a letter that Dr. Edward Condon wrote to McGraw-Hill, and in that letter, Edward Condon stated, if you need anyone in the media to make public statements about UFOs, I would advise you to use Philip Class.
Condon certainly worked hard to try to promote Philip Class as much as possible as someone who would be relied upon to give the proper perspective on UFOs, that is the skeptical debunking attitude on UFOs, through the media. Class is someone who was able to get New York Times op-ed pieces and articles, like, no problem. He was on CNN all the time, Larry King. He was always able to get access to major media in a way that normal UFO researchers would have just, you know, given up an arm to be able to have, but Class just had this magical ability to connect with all major media. And you could certainly say that Class is a new version of a man in black, not in any way like the mysterious, intimidating figures coming to your house. He would just smear you and try to destroy your career.
The men in black were known for threatening witnesses and reporters of strange occurrences, such as that of the Mothman sightings, into not saying anything at all. They are sometimes thought of as damage control, as if it is their job to contain and stifle information from getting out to the general public. One example of this was Mary Heyer, who was a reporter for the newspaper The Athens Messenger in Athens, Ohio, and was the acting manager of the sister office on 6th Street in downtown Point Pleasant, West Virginia. During the Mothman sightings in Point Pleasant, Mary Heyer would often report strange occurrences in her newspaper column entitled, Where the Water Mingles. Along with the Mothman, Heyer documented strange occurrences happening in Point Pleasant in 1966 and 1967 and was reportedly loved by locals due to her professional and open-minded take on the subject. In 1 week alone, Heyer received 500 reports of UFOs from the locals. Heyer's fascination with flying saucers stemmed from her own sighting of a UFO, which she claimed flew over her backyard. She was often relentless in her endeavors to report the strange phenomenon going on in Point Pleasant. Some believe this led to the strange Men in Black paying her a regular scheduled visit to her office in attempts of putting a stop to her release of newspaper reports. Heyer claims to have been visited by strange, oriental-looking men dressed in black who told her to stop researching the subject of flying saucers. This would not be the only strange experience Heyer had with unusual-looking people. Heyer also reported an encounter with an extremely short man with large, hypnotic eyes, as she puts it. The man was not dressed for the cold weather of the time and asked Heyer for directions to a nearby town. During this encounter, the man picked up a ballpoint pen off Heyer's desk and stared at it, as if he had never seen such an object before. The man later fled the room laughing, with no one seeing where he disappeared to. Sometime later, Heyer had another run-in with a strange little person while exiting her work and heading to her car after working late one night. The man just stood there and stared at Heyer until a black car raced around the corner and picked him up. Heyer never encountered the strange dwarf-looking man again, though she did find out that other Men in Black type people were going around Point Pleasant asking for an interview and to photograph people who'd witnessed UFOs or had paranormal encounters. These Men in Black claimed to be close friends of Heyer in an attempt to get people to speak to them. Author John Keel subsequently dubbed these individuals as phantom photographers. Another witness of the Men in Black on Sunday, November 27, 1966, at about 10:30 in the morning, was 18-year-old Connie Carpenter, who was driving home from church, when she came face-to-face with a Mothman, almost causing her to have a car crash. She described the creature as gray, standing on a golf course near Mason, West Virginia. The creature, known as a Mothman, then suddenly flew straight to her car. She was one of a few who actually saw this creature's face. Connie Carpenter was to have many hardships after her Mothman sighting. In early February of 1967, she got married to Keith Gordon. They moved across the river to a two-family house in Middleport, Ohio. At 8:15 a.m. on February 22, 1967, Connie left her house to go to school. As she started to walk down the street, a large black car pulls up alongside her. She later identifies this car as a 1949 Buick. The occupant of the car opened the door and signaled her to come over. Thinking that the individual was looking for directions, Connie Carpenter approached him. He was young, clean-cut, of about 25 years of age, and wearing a colorful mod shirt. No jacket, even though it was extremely cold outside, and he had neatly combed hair with a tan. This tan is very interesting, as it turns up in other MIB encounters. Connie said that the car was brand new inside, even though it was a vintage model. This detail has also popped up in other MIB investigations. As she came closer to the man, he grabs her, and then she struggles and manages to get away. Today, Connie Carpenter's MIB episode is one of the most stranger and more memorable MIB encounters, as it has an overlapping relationship with the Mothman. On November 1966, another sighting of the Mothman and the Men in Black took place in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, as 13-year-old Faye Dua Laporte and her sibling decided to see if they could see the mythical Mothman said to be haunting the area.
He got up out of bed, peeked, and saw there was an Army officer standing
at
the door.
As her older brother Topper had
the individual
heard of the sightings,
was wearing a U.S. Army uniform,
once and for all.
Aside from his clothes, strangely, he looked just like the foreigners from the airplane crash site. Slightly taller, but with the same dark skin complexion and slanted eyes as the others. "You picked up something today," he said. "We need it back." Mr. Cole, being half awake, was confused by that statement. He then recalled the metal thingamajig he had brought back with him, which was still in his coat pocket. Cole retrieved it and asked, "Is this what you mean?" Instead of verbally responding, the unusual Army officer grabbed it from him and proceeded to leave. No words spoken. Cole didn't notice any vehicle or means of transportation, which struck him as odd. After heading back to sleep, Mr. Cole began to wonder about certain aspects of the previous day. For one thing, just how did that army officer find out where he lived? A couple of days later, he returned to the clearing in the woods. Nothing remained of the incident. The grass and bushes were all pressed and crushed down where the object once sat. But other than that, there was no indication of anything having happened there to begin with. Following the visit by the strange army officer, Cole decided that it'd be best he leave the case alone, theorizing that it may have involved a secret matter of sorts that could have been tied to national security for all he knew. As I mentioned earlier, there have indeed been reports of women in black, but their numbers are significantly fewer, possibly only a handful. Alternatively, it may be more precise to state that there are far fewer reported incidents of WIB than their male counterparts. Let's examine one such WIB case. As I have previously mentioned, Albert Bender's cousin had experienced a visit from a woman in black, though the details are very limited. Nevertheless, the strange story of a man named Colin Perks provides a more detailed account. He had an intense fixation on discovering the final resting place of the mythical King Arthur, which he came to believe was located near an old abbey in the ancient English town of Glastonbury. During the latter part of the year 2000, when Perks was fervently exploring the stories of King Arthur, he received a strange and precisely worded phone call from a woman. The woman expressed a desire to discuss his research with him in person. This call left Perks feeling deeply unsettled, as he had no close family and only a few friends and colleagues who even knew about his keen interest in the tales and mythology related to the ancient king. However, the fact that the woman seemed to have knowledge about Perks' fascination with the subject persuaded him to agree to meet her, even at his own residence, which was located not far from the fabled town of Glastonbury. At around 7 p.m., there was a loud knock at the front door. Perks opened the door and was greeted by a woman who he deemed the most stunning he had ever encountered. She was approximately 6 feet tall, appeared to be around 40 years old, had a head of flowing black hair and a complexion as white as milk. Her expensive black suit was stylish and sophisticated. While introducing herself as Miss Sarah Key, she was, in essence, a woman in black. She stood silently for a moment, seeking permission to enter. Perks disregarded caution and invited Miss Key into his home. She claimed to have been following his research closely. Key then proceeded to list details about Perks' search for the remains of King Arthur, stating that her visit was on behalf of a select group of people in the British ruling elite, who were concerned about certain aspects of his studies. According to Key, uncovering the resting place of King Arthur would open a gateway to a realm inhabited by terrifying creatures that could cause chaos if allowed into our world. She urged Perks to stop his investigations and warned him that if he persisted, he would receive another visitor who he would not want to meet.
In a green 1959 Ford truck, as they drove, the Mothman appeared and began to run alongside the car. Terrified, Faye found herself face to face with a creature through the car window. Her brother told her not to look, but she caught a glimpse of the monster anyways out of the corner of her eye. When the Mothman witnessed, Faye Dewitt LaPorte and her brother wanted to return to the TNT area just a few days later, it was blocked off by two men in black who would not let them enter the area. In modern-day UFO study, many researchers take the view that the men in black are some type of agents from some secret government agency, the idea being that dark-suited figures have the government's blessing to intimidate and terrorize witnesses of UFOs. But in reality, authors and researchers like John Keel and Nick Redfern have proven that there is very little evidence to suggest that the majority of men in black are from any type of government agency in the United States or elsewhere. Yes, there could be an exception, but it is highly unlikely. John Keel himself was not only the author of the Mothman prophecies, but he was also somebody who dug very deeply into the matter of the men in black, who they were and where they came from. In February of 1967, Keel had the opportunity to interview Colonel George P. Freeman. Colonel Freeman of the U.S. Air Force made the following following written statement about the men in black, which Kiel wrote about in his literature. Mysterious men dressed in Air Force uniforms or bearing impressive credentials from government agencies have been silencing UFO witnesses. We have checked a number of these cases, and these men are not connected to the Air Force in any way. We haven't been able to find out anything about these men. By posing as Air Force officers and government agents, they are committing a federal offense. We would sure like to catch one. Unfortunately, the trail is always too cold by the time we hear about these cases, but we are still trying. Less than 1 month later, specifically on March 1st of 1967, Lieutenant General Hewitt T. Wallace of the United States Air Force penned the following memo, which was widely circulated within the military. Information not verifiable has reached the headquarters of the United States Air Force that persons claiming to represent the Air Force or other defense establishments have contacted citizens who have sighted unidentified flying objects. In one reported case, an individual in civilian clothes who represented himself as a member of NORAD demanded and received photos belonging to a private citizen. The document continues. In another, a person in Air Force uniform approached local police and other citizens who sighted a UFO, assembled them in a schoolroom, and told them that they did not see what they thought they saw, and they should not talk to anybody about the sighting. All military and civilian personnel, and particularly information officers and UFO investigating officers who hear such reports, should immediately notify their local OSI offices. So if not members of the Navy, Air Force, Army, or if not a part of the intelligence apparatus, such as the CIA or the FBI, then just who or what are the men in black?
Flying out of 7-5 is the sighting. Poor Miller went to the American Air Force, and one day while coming home from a hunting trip,
recovered was a radar target.
No, it was that is the cover story that was put out. No, it was a cover story based on the testimony of the people who put out the cover story.
Whatever happened in West, or whatever the objects were, they were being tracked. They were being tracked from where they were coming from. They'd been tracked over previous days, and there was some sense of there being a surveillance going on with these objects, and that's why the response could be as fast as it was to West. That's why the military could get there as quickly as they did that day. Because there was some, if you like, forewarning that perhaps these objects had been seen elsewhere in Australia in preceding days. Certainly we have the famous photograph of a UFO taken in the suburb of Baldwin, about 20 kilometres from Westall, just 4 days before the Westall incident. And that photograph was leaked to a Melbourne newspaper, the Herald, published, and caused a huge furor at the time, so much so that the person who took the photograph himself, even though he didn't want it published in the newspaper, he gave it to a friend who leaked it. He never wanted it made public, but it was, and it then resulted in the Air Force visiting him at his home, and an interview was held with him, and he claims to this day that he thinks the Air Force was so concerned about that photograph going into the newspaper was because it showed the object that was seen at Westall 4 days later, or there was some connection with whatever that object was that he caught in his Polaroid photograph and with what happened. So that's an ongoing mystery. How could it be that an object of unknown origin, an object that flew in ways that were completely inexplicable to anybody who witnessed it, how there could be such a rapid response by the military, whether it was the Army or the Air Force?
There's another very interesting case in Australia, outside the city of Melbourne, south part of Australia, a town called Westall. And this is 1966. This is a really incredible UFO incident. I had the privilege of visiting Westall myself some years ago and going to the schoolyard where all of this happened. And the story was all the kids run out of the school because someone saw this UFO coming over the property there. You got 200 kids of all ages and teachers. There were adults and youths that were watching this. The object by all of the witness accounts, either landed or almost landed on the property. Like very, very low. In fact, one girl, she's in like junior high school age, she got the closest to it, and according to the witnesses, like she was not far away. But what we know for certain, there was a science teacher named Daniel who stated that these looked like Australian Air Force came to his house. And there are two of them, and they absolutely threatened his career and possibly his freedom if he was to continue talking about this. And they made it clear in no uncertain terms, you're not going to talk about this.
Remember, the military, the emergency services arrived. There was a response by colleagues, the fire brigade, by the civil defense organization. There was a response by the Commonwealth police. There was a report from a witness who was a news stringer at the time that had cordoned the shrine up around the streets of Westall by police officers in uniforms that were a little unknown to him, using vehicles that were a little unknown to him, but they looked like police officers and police vehicles. And when he returned to the TV station later that day, he was informed that, yes, they were Commonwealth police officers, not Victorian state police officers, but Commonwealth police officers. So it looked like there was some involvement at that level as well.
While I think that he might have started out with a paranormal element, I think it may have been that the government tweaked this and they used it as a psychological operation or a test tube to try out various forms of psychological control.
Japan Airlines Flight 1628 en route to Tokyo from Paris when the crew noticed two UFOs with flowing lights which flew next to the plane in patterns and speeds which were unachievable with modern aviation.
The controller had asked the military man, do you see anything? The military confirmed the position. The military controller has what they call height-finding radar, and they have long-range radar and short-range radar. So if they don't catch it on one of their systems, they catch it on the other. And if you listen to the military man, at one time he said, I have it on the height radar, or my range radar, which indicated that he had a target on his system. Oz would report it. While they ran through for the best part of 31 minutes, the UFO would be in one position or the other following our Japanese 747. After a while, they changed his altitude. It still stayed with him. They gave him a 360. When you're 747, you make a 360. It takes you a few minutes to turn around. You cover a lot of space. It still stayed with him. He's in the front, on the side, or behind.
10, I approved 1628 to make deviations as necessary for traffic. The traffic stayed with 1628 through turns and descents in the vicinity of Fairbanks.
Another very interesting, we can call this a Men in Black incident in a way. And by the way, relating to that encounter, good old Philip J. Class was able to work his way with his organization, which was called PSYCOP, the committee, scientific committee to investigate claims of the paranormal. They have a different name now. And they were able to get a piece in the New York Times during all of that to debunk the whole thing and say, well, it was just a planet Jupiter. You guys don't know what you're saying. You're a big mistake. But in 1986, we have an interesting occurrence. On November 17th of that year, there was a flight called JAL, Japan Airlines Flight 1628, from Tokyo, and they were going over the over like the Arctic Circle area, actually flying down over the state of Alaska. And this entire 29-minute recorded incident occurred. This airliner was
talking about government and conspiracies, and none of it made any sense to me. But she goes, they were very, very scary. She said they had no eyebrows, no eyelashes, nothing. Their hair looked like they had a wig on, like it was attached to their hat, like it wasn't even real. And she said, and the scariest thing, their eyes were so big. and so blue that they almost hypnotized me a little bit. And she goes, and you're going to think I'm crazy when I tell you this, but I swear they knew what I was thinking. And she started to cry, and she said one more thing before she left. She said, these men, they didn't blink. Not once did I see them blink.
The men could somehow speak to Bender's mind directly without actually saying anything. They forced him to destroy all his findings and stop his research altogether. As soon as this encounter took place, Bender was scarred for life.
Who had been watching Jack Robinson and his wife for several nights. Jack Robinson was a Jersey City UFO investigator and believes he and his wife were under surveillance by a man in black who knew of Jack's extensive UFO research. The man would often be seen in the doorway of a building directly opposite Jack's home. And on more than one occasion, Jack and his wife would return home to find the house not as they'd left it. It wasn't a mess, but they could tell someone had been in there, and Jack could tell his UFO research papers had been disturbed. Jack's wife said that she had seen a man dressed in black looking up at the house with an emotionless look on his face, and they became convinced they were being observed. They mentioned the strange activity to Timothy Beckley and his friend Jim, and the pair decided to drive over to the house to check it out for themselves. And sure enough, just as Jack and his wife had described, a man dressed in black was stood in a doorway looking up at the house. Tim managed to take this photo and believes it's genuine proof of the Men in Black's existence. Shortly after the photograph was taken, the mysterious man was never seen again. Now, I know it could easily be faked, but no one has come forward to prove that it is, so we may never know. You see, the problem with these reported encounters is that they come from people who claim they have been contacted. And in general, most people do not believe that random members of the public are credible witnesses with objects.
Drawings of it by the pilot, his name is Kenjiro Terauchi, and it's almost like this massive, like the planet Saturn, it's like this big, big, roundish object. They're watching it, and they're scared out of their mind, and they've got it on their airborne radar. It's ground radar also is tracking this object, and as I recall, at least one other airliner in the area saw this thing visually. Lots of data points here. What's interesting about this case is that they're flying side by side this gigantic object, and it releases a smaller object. Or at least I think it must release it, because the smaller object gets in front of their cockpit. And in fact, it's two of them, where their cockpit is bathed in this green light for a while. But they're, as they're flying, these objects are pacing them, like they're in front of the cockpit, and with maneuverability that's, like, there's no way to explain how these objects could do the things that they're doing. They eventually depart. You can imagine the fear. So Terauchi is getting permission to try to move his aircraft differently just to get away from this thing. And the entire experience lasted for 29 minutes in terms of the actual operation.
Next day, I got a call from someone with the scientific study groups or the CIA, and they wanted to know, they had some questions about the incident. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about, you probably want to call the admiral. And later, the admiral called down and says, I set up a briefing tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. In the round room, bring all the stuff you have, bring everybody up there, and give them whatever they want.
So that's interesting enough. In the aftermath of that, there was an FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration meeting, where they're discussing this. They've got all the radar data. In this meeting, this is now according to one of the men who attended, his name is John Callahan. He's an FAA senior official in the Federal Aviation Administration. And so what happened, according to Callahan's very vivid, explicit testimony, was that at one point these two men in dark suits enter the room. No one knows where they're from. This is assumed that they're from CIA. I don't think that's ever made clear where these guys are from. But there they come in and they confiscate all of the data. They are warning everyone, you are never, ever, ever going to talk about this. Callahan man kept his copy. That was the thing. He didn't let them know. They didn't ask. I don't think they asked him directly for it. He just kind of slipped below the radar, as it were, in this meeting and left it with his copy of the radar. And it was about 13 years later, I think, in the late 90s, where he was interviewed by Steve Greer about this project and told the story. And so what you've got here is another incident of very clear, this is not a paranormal Men in Black experience. These are government guys. These are spooks who are confiscating the evidence. Now, who are they? Are they CIA? Are they NSA? Are they something else? Are they from the Majestic 12 or whatever, you know, comparable organization it would be to Majestic 12? Maybe it's called Zodiac. That's a very possibility. But they're from a group that their job was to take that UFO. Callahan is really worth listening to. He's very upfront, extremely candid, very articulate, very smart. And he's got the credibility and the background to back up what he said. That's the thing that makes him so compelling.
When they read the reports that come through, the FAA has to protect themselves. You can't say he saw a target, even though he's in excess. So they made him change his report to position symbols, which makes it sound like it wasn't really a target. Well, if it's not a target, then a lot of the other position symbols that were separating from our targets. When I read that, I thought that is an official hit. That somebody's worried about something rather than trying to.
Who do the Men in Black work for? CIA? The FBI? The NSA? Something else entirely? Even in the military, the Men in Black are a mystery. Over the years, encounters with Men in Black have decreased as their legend has grown, even into pop culture. No longer are you interrogated and threatened by a government spook or a nameless agent from an unknown cabal of organizations. As proxies continue debunking and smearing credible witnesses, the Men in Black have evolved their technique to control the narrative through misinformation. Literally, fake news. Take Richard Doty, former special agent of the Air Force, who was tasked with infiltrating the UFO community to instill doubt and misinformation of UFO encounters.
Men in Black have always been present in the UFO community. And if the sighting or report of a sighting or acquisition of photographs were important to the government, Men in Black would show up trying to obtain what information that witnesses had regarding the sighting. Ever since the 50s, people started seeing flying objects, reporting flying objects, depending on the accuracy and the credibility of the people that observed these objects. And depending on what the government knew about what those sightings were, it would depend on whether the government went out and got the information and tried to quiet witnesses and saw it. But it's happened. It's real. It's a controversial subject matter with both within the public and within the government. But my knowledge is I've actually been involved in the Men in Black. We didn't call it Men in Black, but there were people within a certain agency within the government, for special activities, the center. They're the ones that control these Men in Black. There was a unit stationed at Fort Belfry, Virginia, that dealt with obtaining information from witnesses. But the controversy.
There's a couple of really strange looking men that work here, and they kind of freaked everybody out, and they were asking questions about you. And of course, now I'm getting a little bit nervous, and I'm like, what are you talking about? And he said, well, they were, he goes, I don't know how to describe them except for extremely odd looking. They were the exact same height, they were wearing the exact same clothes, and they had the exact same faces, like they were twins. And he said they were wearing black suits, black trench coats, they were wearing like the old-fashioned Panero hat. They had extremely, extremely pale skin. And he said they came in and they asked for you. And I said, I'm sorry, he's actually not working today. And it seemed like they didn't believe me, so they started to walk around the hotel, and shortly after they went to the tour desk, but they freaked me out, and I really wanted to tell you that there were these weird guys in here looking for you. So, of course, now I'm a little bit skeptical and a little bit freaked out all at the same time, so the first thing I do is I run into my security office, and I rewound the cameras,
because you're next,
and sure enough,
but I want to go to ground
here comes two gentlemen through the front door, looking exactly how he described. Then, the next day, I was talking with my tour guest, and one of them asked to talk to me. She came in my office, his name is Mike Hellman, and she said, I heard that you heard that there were some men looking for you, and she said, they asked a few questions about you, and they said strange things that I didn't understand, that they were talking about government and conspiracies, and none of it made any sense to me. But she goes, they were very, very scary. She said they had no eyebrows, no eyelashes, nothing. Their hair looked like they had a wig on, like it was attached to their hat, like it wasn't even real. And she said, and the scariest thing, their eyes were so big and so blue that they almost hypnotized me a little bit. And she goes, and you're going to think I'm crazy when I tell you this, but I swear they knew what I was thinking. And she started to cry, and she said one more thing before she left. She said, these men, they didn't blink. Not once did I see them blink.
But it all starts there.
Ominous message, Key abruptly left.
The men,
despite her warning, Perks continued his research,
MIBs.
And as predicted,
is the man
in some cases do not appear to be of human origin.
Perks was driving home from Bath on a Saturday evening in his Razor 2000 when he found himself
a strange man
despite being on the outskirts of a busy city. Perks took notes and he
thought he showed him the corridor and watched it
suck down the staff. Saw what appeared to be a large man standing
there. There's various reports of
straddling the sense. Perks slowed down his vehicle and realized when his
And of course,
and started
now
taking
I'm getting a little bit nervous, and I'm like, what are you talking 35 about?
35 millimeter camera.
And
this man took the pictures and went in the house, not thinking much about it. Thinking.
Except for extremely odd looking. They were the exact same height, they were wearing the exact same clothes, and they had the exact same faces, like they were twins. And he said they were wearing black suits, black trench coats.
finale for my tragedy, like a miserere meant for only me, while I linger weary neath the willow tree. Right here, our romance was started. Here again we parted. When I set you free, all my thoughts are jumbled. Everything is blurred. All the world has crumbled, shattered by a word. The end has come. My heart is numb. Was like a ball from a blue above. I can't believe it, but you're gone, darling, and here lies love. The sky is dark, I hear a lark, he sounds as sad as a mournful dove. There's only one thing I'm conscious of. I only know I can't go on, darling, and here lies love.
Where people share the music they love. 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Find our program schedule in every issue of Stylus Magazine.
Saturday morning show on CKUW FM. Co-host Carol McKibben and I are here every Saturday morning from 6 to 8 with an invitation to start your weekend with us. Companionable radio is our mantra, and our regular features include our search for ancient radio waves. I send Carol up on the roof at 6:15 with a microphone taped to a bamboo pole, and we go fishing for fantastic finds. At 6:45, laughter is the best medicine, and our comedy spot ranges from Bob and Ray to Victor Borg, Wayne and Schuster to BBC Treasures. 7:15, wake them, shake them. Yes, it's the Children's Corner. 7:45, you'll hear author interviews in season with autographed copies to give away or a passage from The Diary of a Bookseller. Now, all of the above is blended with music that suits the time. No heavy metal, please. We have a soft spot for the overlooked and underappreciated, so cue the ukulele, the zither, the tuba, and the handbell chorus. Just call us the Eclectic Circus. Saturday morning, 6 to 8 on CKUW-FM.
Homelessness is a lot like musical chairs. except not with chairs.
When the music stops, more than a quarter of a million Canadians, many of them children, don't have a home.
But if we act right now with urgency, we can fix it.
Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca.
Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
Got a bike or some parts you want to put to good use? Drop them off at any of the City of Winnipeg's 4R locations.